You know, the joys of and pains of collaboration. The thing about the difficult thing about collaboration is that you have to work with another human being, and of course the great thing is that you get to work with another human being. So it's both the good and bad things are the kinds of those kinds of interactions. But as I started off saying, I don't do design and I don't do choreography, and I was very quickly I found I had to find these people.
That was Philip Glass, probably the most powerful theater composer of this century, at his summer home in Cape Breton. This is Rock Meets Bone. I'm Brian Guns. Philip Glass composes for opera, symphony, chorus, dance, theater, and film. Recently, the Metropolitan Opera commissioned him to write The Voyage to mark the 500th anniversary of Columbus' arrival in the New World. His first opera, Einstein on the Beach, is regarded as the seminal music theater work of our time. That was followed by two more operas, Satyagraha, which was about Gandhi, and Akhenaten. The music on this program is from that trilogy of portrait operas, as well as Philip's solo piano recordings. Philip Glass's connection with Nova Scotia goes back a long way. Over the past 20 summers at his Inverness County home, perched just back from the cliff edge, he composed much of the music now heard round the world. Before heading back to New York City at the end of another summer's work, Philip Glass talked with Sam Burkholz and composer Peter Lieberson around his picnic table, while the breeze from the Gulf of St. Lawrence rumbled through our microphone.
It's really an environment. I mean, it's a total environment. You might as well talk about how it smells or, you know, how it
how
looks.
Does it smell? How does
it smells smell? Great. Can't you smell it on this program?
It's a smell-o-vision.
You hear the ocean. I don't know. It's the people that come up here think of the place as a, you know, as a place that, you know, all your senses are tuned to it. In the late 60s and early 70s, there were a lot of people that went and moved to what they called the land, wherever that might be.
Do you
remember?
We
all remember that.
No,
not really.
So what brought you here?
The real reason I came here was because my children were just being born, and I didn't want them to spend their whole entire 12 months of the year in an urban environment. So I just simply wanted to find a place that I could go with my family. My first reason was for that. And in fact, the kids have spent every summer of their life up here. It turned out then what I discovered are the things for myself. My actual reason for going were very simple ones. I was a new father with a young family, and I was looking for a place that they could get out and run around in. You can't do that in New York City, by the way. No one runs around in New York. If you're around in New York, you're probably someone's running after you. We were very much a part of the generation of people that later called hippies, and but we were the artist variety who tend to be always rather extraordinarily hardworking people in point of fact, which is kind of a secret to a lot of people, but they don't have a lot of time to grow organic tomatoes or whatever people do in the country when they went and started communes, or even to sit for 8 or 10 hours a day, which some other people did. Mostly artists come into the country and they work. One did have a sense that you were, we were connected in many ways to other people who were. There was a feeling that the counterculture was establishing places outside of the big cities. And in some sense, I'm sure we were affected by that.
Did you feel quite accepted into this community here?
Well, in fact, we did. Mm-hmm. The people, there weren't a lot of people from away, as we say up here. There weren't a lot of people from away here anyway. Our first, the way you found, you know, there weren't any real estate agents in those days. There are barely any now. But what you did is, if you were looking for a place, you went down the road and you knocked on people's door and you sat in their kitchen and you talked with them. And you did a lot of, you drank a lot of that red rose tea, you know, that they drink up here. They're real strong. You drink a lot of tea. And you spend a lot, and people wanted to know who you were, what you were doing. You talked for a while, and then you would say, well, by the way, we were looking for a place. And said, well, why don't you talk to Rankin down the road? Or why don't you talk to so-and-so or McPherson or McLeod or whoever? And you went over to the next place. Eventually, you find a place. That was how you found places. So in order to find a place in those days, you met a lot of people. You actually did. When there are get-togethers here, they are not exclusively, they're never exclusively from people that are from away. They're usually mixed, it's a mixture of people that are here and people from away. There's not a feeling of being isolated at all. No, of course, in many ways we are. We're not here in the year, and for many of us, we're not here in the winter. And there are a lot of the experiences of this that we don't have. But now when I come up here, people say, well, when did you get home?
Home?
Yeah. They said, that's what they say. They said, how long have you been home, Philip? So, of course, I've been coming up here for 20 years. I'm older than most of I've been here longer than their children have been born or been around. So,
Well,
they used to say, when did you land?
Uh-huh. That's a big change, isn't it?
Yeah.
Landing and coming.
Yeah, we say, how long have you been home for? The thing that is so striking about the environment, especially where we are, is that a lot of people say that they're really thrown on themselves in a way. They're thrown on their own resources. That it's fairly isolated, and the people you know live fairly isolated lives too. So that you get to spend a lot of time by yourself, which is something that we talk about, something that we want to do, but we don't often get to do it, especially those of us that have come from the big North American cities, especially the East Coast cities. Things are very spread out up here, too. When I talk about visiting a friend who is 25 miles away, of course, that's not very far. But I don't see him too often, either.
Right.
So the first thing is there's a remoteness about the place. The other great thing about is that no one comes to see you.
Except for us, right?
Well, you guys, so that's different. But even then, Halifax is a bit of a hike, isn't it?
Yes.
But if I say to my friends who might live in Boston or Chicago or, say, Los Angeles, come and drop in sometime, there's very little chance they will. You're pretty safe from any people dropping in. So there's that remoteness. And then there's the remoteness within the community itself, that the places are pretty spread out, houses are pretty far apart. And so that you really are thrown on your own time a lot, which is, if you said that to people up here, they wouldn't know what you were talking about, but for what we're talking about city people, it really is extraordinary. I don't just mean that it's quiet and you don't hear a lot of noise. Different kind of noise. I did an opera a couple of years ago with Doris Lessing, and she was visiting me in New York, and she was complaining about the noise, and she said, "But Philip, why don't you complain?" And I said, "But Doris, to whom should I complain?" For me, I don't locate. I don't have a feeling of location very much, particularly. I mean, I personally don't. So I don't have that particular feeling myself. And I do travel. As I'm quite capable of going to a city I've never lived in and just getting a place and staying there for a month.
Mm-hmm. Sense of retreat.
Kind of, but so and I don't identify myself with place very much. I mean, I think it's very unlikely that you'll hear any Scottish fiddle music turning up in my music. And I do like the music, but I haven't made that connection. I came here at a point in my musical life where I was on my own. I had charted my course in a way. I wonder, had I come here 10 years earlier, whether that would have been true. But that's a question we won't know.
Yeah.
When you mean you were... You knew what you wanted to do when you moved. You'd started doing it.
By 1969, I had established my ensemble. I had made my first records. I was touring, not with the regularity that I'm touring now, but the musical identity was already crystallizing. I was 32, mm-hmm. which is about the time when composers start hearing their own voice. If they do, sometimes they hear it later. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they never hear it. So, but I had already made, I had been living in Paris before that, and had come into contact with non-Western music through Ravi Shankar, spent some time with him and gone to India a number of times. And I was starting to have a command of a personal musical language. So that the most extraordinary music could have been right around me, and at that moment I would not have noticed it, probably. Because I had already just gone through that, you see. But as I say, I can only wonder what would have happened had I come 5 years earlier. Yes. But then again, I wouldn't have, because I wouldn't have had the kids, you see. So the whole thing, it only happens the way it can happen.
Thank you.
I spend a lot of the woods over there. I spend a lot of time in the woods over there. I saw you looking at some of the little cabins there. I've done a lot of music up here, starting from a piece called Music with Changing Parts in 1970. Almost major portions of every opera I've written have been done up here, including a lot of Einstein, Satyagraha, Akhenaten. The Juniper Tree was pretty much planned up and written up here. I think Usher, a good part of Usher was done up here. Mm-hmm. And now I'm writing The Voyage, which is a new opera for the Met. So that's, and I'm used to that. I'm used to working in the woods. And I can, what I do is I often start pieces here and then I carry them on to the, into the year in the city. And sometimes if they're big operas, they carry into the next summer. It usually is a summer, a year and a summer with those big pieces.
Do you find that you work differently up here than you might in New York?
Not so differently, in fact, because my work habits are fairly well established now. I do have more time, though. During the year, I spend a lot of the time in New York City, and my writing day begins the same both in New York and here. It begins. I get up at around 5, and I start working at 6, and I stop writing around noon. In New York, noon is the absolute end, because the rest of the day I'm working either in rehearsals or I'm at working in recordings or all the talking to copyists or you know, all the things that composers, that we spend our time doing that doesn't have to do with writing music. Mm-hmm. Up here, I stop at noon, but then I don't have to go anywhere. So I can have an afternoon period, too. If you can get up to 8 or 10 hours a day, if you can find the time, then what happens is that there's a kind of a night shift effect that takes over. You start working in your sleep. Mm-hmm. It's kind of, you just find that you're thinking about the piece all the time. I think there's another factor, though, which is that you become, I think, even if you don't work more hours up here than one would in the city, I think the lack of distractions allows you to center your energy more into what you're doing, even if you may not be working that many more hours. This kind of alternation between intensely working and almost as intensely reposing. You see, I'm really a theater composer, so from what I know of your music, you're really a concert composer. You really do concert music.
So thus far.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I've worked in the theater since I was 20. That's really what I do. My concerts are really concert versions of pieces I do in the theater. The Voyage is coming along. This is the opera that I'm doing for the Met for 92. And it's in honor of the... I think the official word is the quinticentennial, the 500th anniversary of Columbus' arrival in this part of the world. And he does appear in the opera. He does appear, but I haven't said much more about it than that. I've done a lot of work in the theater, which has focused as subject matter a person, whether it was Einstein or Gandhi and Satyagraha, Akhenaten. I did those three, and then I stopped doing that because I called them portrait operas, and I got tired of doing them because it seemed to me I wouldn't be allowed to do anything but them. You know, we get typecast in music just the way actors get in the theater, or writers get typecast, you know. And I wanted to break it, so I purposely stopped doing the portrait operas, and I did a number of other pieces, more about stories or more abstract pieces even. But they're inspiring people.
Yes.
They inspire us, and they illuminate our lives, and they nourish us in ways, and that's why they're so important.
You say that that people came up here to work with you. How much of your, and also that you said that you're a theater composer, primarily, how much of your work is collaborative? How much do you regard it as collaborative?
Almost 100%.
But from the beginning, I mean, when you...
But actually from the beginning. Mm-hmm. The way I work here is that the actual idea of a piece isn't really so... really the starting point, though it would seem to be. As soon as I get an idea for a piece, I get together a designer, a writer, and a director, sometimes a choreographer. So I work from the very beginning with my collaborators. It works in a number of ways. I don't always instigate the collaborations, but often I do. The piece doesn't go forward for me until the team is together. It's very, what's usual for me is to spend about a year with a team of people. The Voyage, which I'm working on now, we've already spent that year. David Huang did the libretto. David Peltney is going to be the stage director. And we began working about April a year ago. The film things I've done, like Godfrey Reggio, those pieces are planned. That's where the film Kainaskatsi and the film Polakatsi, those films are planned together. In other words, we begin working on it before he shoots the first roll of film. We work on the screenplay. It's really like a treatment because he doesn't use words in his movies. With Paul Schrader, who did the film Mishima, that Paul called me up, but he had not written the screenplay when he called me, and he was starting to work on it, and we began having meetings, and I saw the screenplay as it was being written, and I went to Japan when he filmed it. So the collaborations are, I make them as complete as I can. And the particular character of my work has grown out of those collaborations. Almost every piece is somewhat different because I also tend not to repeat the same team exactly. For example, when I work with Godfrey on Kainaskatsi, Ron Fricke was a cinematographer, but the next time he wasn't. There was a different cinematographer. I'm working with David Huang on The Voyage, but he wrote The Thousand Airplanes on the Roof, but we had a different designer, a different director. So what I tend to do is to... I have a kind of I suppose a horror of repeating, especially a successful piece. I have a I'm terrified of putting the same group of people together and finding that somehow we're stuck in the old piece. You can see how that would happen.
Absolutely.
That you would be making the same, you know, well, it worked last time, you know.
Yeah.
And there you so then instead of doing Satyagraha as my second opera, I would have done The Son of Einstein,
right.
You know. And I didn't want to do that.
Again, there was silence as the two lovers sat on a park bench, their bodies touching, holding hands in the moonlight. Once more she spoke. How much do you love me, John? She asked. He answered. How much do I love you? Count the stars in the sky. Measure the waters of the oceans with a teaspoon. Number the grains of sand on the seashore. Impossible, you say?
You know, the joys of and pains of collaboration. The thing about the difficult thing about collaboration is that you have to work with another human being, and of course the great thing is that you get to work with another human being. So, it's both the good and bad things are the kinds of those kinds of interactions. But as I started off saying, I don't do design and I don't do choreography, and I was very quickly I found I had to find these people. I had to find choreographers, I had to find designers, I had to find directors to work with.
So you're sort of the opposite of the Wagnerian approach in a way, that, you know, he did it all himself.
That's right. It's not the idea, it's not the vision of one person. So you have to be willing to give up the idea that it's a great lesson, actually, that the piece doesn't belong to you. You get rid of that idea, and then it gets a lot more interesting.
I'd like to thank Philip Glass for his hospitality, Sam Burkholz and Peter Lieberson for their interviewing, and Gordon Kidd and Debbie Cates for help with post-production. Rock Meets Bone is produced with the assistance of the Naropa Institute of Canada. Thanks for listening.